Welcome to Haunted Hospitality, Southern Stories Told by Spooky Gingers. I'm Robin.
And I'm Zoe.
And I have a story for you today. But first, Zoe, how's life and what's going on with your curtain in the background?
Well, yes, we're recording virtually again, and so we are videoing our faces, and my curtain is magically moving all by itself.
How haunted.
How haunted.
How spooky.
Oh, you can see her in the bottom corner right there. Soup has the zoomies right now.
Hi, Soup.
So I apologize if I randomly scream out in pain at any time.
You know what? Just to cover our bases, I also apologize if I randomly scream out in pain at any time. You never know what could happen in this life.
Exactly. I'll do my best to edit it out, though.
No, I think they want to hear that.
Oh, okay. Well, it's snowing.
It is snowing.
So I love snow. You know I love snow.
I got that last night. I actually don't think I've really seen you in the snow before, but you did text me letting me know the weather in the surrounding areas and notifying me that you did not have snow yet.
Yes. So my family's from Massachusetts, so I grew up being able to see photos of my cousins and my half-siblings and everybody else in my family playing in the snow. And I'm sitting here in South Carolina, and it's not snowing. And so,
it does not snow.
I grew up with, snow jealousy. Like, FOMO snow. Snow FOMO? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, every time it snows, I have to, I already made a little snowman about this big on top of my car. I'm so happy. But I do have to say, I told myself, I was like, I'm not driving anywhere Friday or Saturday. I'm not driving anywhere Friday or Saturday. All day, both days, from midnight to midnight, I'm not driving anywhere. And then Kari gets a flat tire on Thursday. So Thursday, I had to go pick him up. And then we got the tow truck there, and the tow truck left. And then I took him to work on Friday. I picked him up from work on Friday, and then had to bring him to Firestone on Friday. So I had to drive around on Friday. Kari's car is still at Firestone.
I am so sorry for Kari's car. I hope Kari can survive that as car for a little bit until the car, Kari's car, is
Kari's
back.
Kari's car, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the reason he got a tow truck was because he doesn't have a spare. So.
Well, yeah. Kari, gotta get a spare.
Yeah. So Robin, how's your life?
It's good. It's also snowing. Mm-hmm. I have a winter wonderland outside my window that I am now gazing at adoringly, lovingly. I have participated in a snowball fight. Oh. I have confirmed that I still have a good left arm for throwing things. I have slipped in the snow. I tracked a deer in the snow.
Oh.
And now I'm in front of you in a computer screen. Busy morning.
Yeah, very busy morning.
Yeah, I plan on doing absolutely nothing tomorrow to compensate.
Makes sense. I did most of my snow activities last night when it was snowing really fat droplets of snow. I mean, fat. And Kari shamed me for shaming Mother Nature, but
it sounds like you weren't shaming it, just commenting on it.
Mother Nature is thick. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, before we get into your
something,
we have a podcast promo for a podcast called A Spooky Tales, and they are a podcast that talk about folklore, haunted places, and all things spooky with a specific focus on Latin America. So let's roll the tape.
If you like all things spooky, then check out A Spooky Tales, hosted by us, Christina
and MJ, where we talk about all things spooky, like paranormal stories, haunted places, myths, and legends,
with a focus on Latin America.
There are new episodes every Friday.
Listen on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts, as well as at SpookyTales.com.
Stay spooky.
And now we are back.
Yay.
Hope you enjoyed that promo. And again, check them out at Spooky Tales. So Zoe.
Yes.
You have a something-something for us.
I do have a something-something for you, and
good, because if you didn't, that would be really disappointing.
Yeah, though I do foresee a future where you say that, and I'm like, oh, shoot, no, I don't.
There's going to be a day where I individually forget. There's going to be a different day where you individually forget. There will be one day
Yes.
Where we both forget. In fact, there was one day already that you forgot one, and I just happened to have two, which is very unlike me.
Yes.
So I gave you one of
mine. I think I forewarned you that
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Good.
Yeah. Do you remember when we were talking about fairy plantation?
Our recent episode? Yes.
Yes. So when we were talking about fairy plantation, I was telling you about how they had this room where they would lay out their dead for a few days before burying them to see if they would wake up.
Yeah.
And then we were like, wait, is that the origin behind awake?
Oh, yeah.
In that episode, we were like, oh, looking up the origins of the word wake would be a good something spooky.
Ah.
So.
Did you do that?
I did that. I wasn't just leading you up to do something completely random. No, actually, this is a creature corner. I just wanted to remind you. So, according to Wikipedia, so this literally, I did not get too fancy with it. So, awake originally was used to refer to a custom in Celtic countries where mourners would stay up to watch over the dead and, like, pray over the dead. So, it wasn't to watch the person wake, you would be staying awake so that you can watch over the dead. And they called it awake. And it was mostly a time of prayer. And also it was kind of for letting your brain realize that this person's dead, you know? Like, you know how if you have a pet who passes away, you're supposed to let your other pets smell the dead pet?
No, I didn't know that.
Okay. Well, that's something I've heard recently. I have no idea how true it is, but they say that you're supposed
to... Most of my pets who passed away, it was like, it was time to... They need to be put down.
Yeah.
So it was at the vet, so you wouldn't necessarily bring the pet back.
Right. I mean, yeah. Maybe it's something that they were on when they passed, but something about the smell of the deceased pet lets the other pets know, oh, okay, they're not coming back.
So staying awake for the night, seeing them, it was a way of processing your grief and kind of maybe getting out of the denial stage.
Exactly, yes. But then they would also pray over the body, but that probably became a reasoning for the instinctual need to stay with the body, you know?
Gotcha.
Yeah.
It's kind of really interesting. I mean, some cultures, like, they're not put off by the idea of the dead body. It really is just a part of processing the grief. But, like, other cultures, I would kind of say maybe a lot of people today, at least where I am in America, it's almost like you don't want to see it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not so much funerals a lot anymore. It's memorials because it's ashes now. And so you'll see the ashes, but you won't see the dead body. And so in that way, it really is kind of hard to process.
Right.
Like, you're just kind of going off, you were told this person died.
Right, yeah.
Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome. Right. So you have a very complex story for us today.
The trial of it ended up taking over about 30 years. And so the trial part of it was very complex. There is a lot to this story. Okay. And so what I'm telling you about today is the life, death, and legacy of civil rights leader Medgar Evers. Have you heard of Medgar Evers?
I don't believe I have.
So I think I had heard of him. I didn't know any specifics. I think I had heard the name and might have known what it was associated with. But over the past week, I've learned a lot more about him. And so now I'm sharing it with you guys.
Okay.
Before we can kind of get into his life, I want to just put some context to it, because this was a lot of the story involves 1960s Mississippi. So the civil rights movement is going on. So I wanted to give a lot of context to basically Jim Crow era South, just because maybe not everybody grew up learning about it the same way we did.
Right.
Because we were from the South. In 1890, and this is sometime after Reconstruction, they started in the South creating these laws that were really influencing every aspect of your daily life, from where you could go to the bathroom, to where you could go to school, to your ability to vote. And so what would happen is they would have these signs up that say, okay, well, whites only for this bathroom. Or there would be a sign over a drinking fountain that said colored. It was segregation. It was separating these people from each other. This went on for decades, about 75 years total. I don't think this was happening so much in the North or other places. It seemed to really be a Southern thing. But like I said, these influenced every facet of life. The idea of it was that this is separate but equal. But as we learn in the outcome of the Brown versus the Board of Education case, I'm pretty sure that was when they put into a Supreme Court ruling. That is not the subject of what I'm talking about today, so I didn't actually look into that specifically, but I do remember the quote, separate but equal is inherently unequal, being associated with the Brown versus Board of Education case, which eventually meant that public schools could be integrated, at least according to federal law, though it took a very long time before a lot of Southern states actually let it happen. Now, a lot of these issues too were that Black people had a lot of limited political power because there were restrictions put in place that limited their ability to vote, including literacy tests and other racially motivated means to stop them from voting. And so I'm telling you all this to say that this was not like a one issue situation. This was permeating every part of life. And so the civil rights movement stretched from the 50s to the 60s. It is especially associated with the 60s. And just, it encompassed a whole bunch of actions from a whole bunch of people, but some big ones, I'm definitely going to go into big ones into this, but for example, you know, Rosa Parks, she was sitting in the bus and, you know, a white man told her to move and she refused to move. And freedom riders traveling around in 1961, they would go into whites-only establishments and would stage peaceful protests there. And so people would see the violence against them from white people who were pro-segregationists. And it really illuminated for a lot of the country what was going on. So people were starting to realize what was happening. And it affected change, ultimately, after a very long period of time. Okay, so Medgar Evers was born on July 2nd, 1925, in the small town of Decatur, Mississippi, to a family of farmers. He was very, very aware of the racist society he was born into from an early age because when he was a kid, a friend of the family was lynched in a field that was nearby his house. And he said that he would pass by the field when he was going hunting growing up, and for a long time, shreds of that guy's clothes remained in the field from the lynching. And so he would see it every time he passed by, and he would always remember, and he would always think about it. And this was one of the things that inspired him to really go into activism as he got older. So he was drafted into the army in 1943 to go and fight in World War II, which he did so fighting in France and Germany, and he received an honorable discharge after the war ended in 1946. After that, in 1948, he started at Alcorn A&M College in Lorman, Mississippi, where he met his wife, Merle Beasley, who became Merle Evers, and they got married when he was a senior, and he graduated in 1952. After he graduated, he and Merle worked at an insurance place called Magnolia Mutual Life Insurance Company. And while he was doing that, he joined the local chapter of a civil rights group and started getting involved in that. And he led a boycott of gas stations that had a segregated bathroom policy. So his work with the NAACP started when he applied in 1954 to the University of Mississippi Law School. Now, the University of Mississippi is also known as Ole Miss.
Okay.
And I tried to look up the timeline of when they shifted their mascot, but they're called the Rebels. And for a long time, like, the visual emblem of that, I think up until 2007 or 2010, was basically a plantation master. Oh. FYI.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So he applied to Ole Miss for the law school, and it was racially segregated. They did not allow Black people to be enrolled at their university. And when he was rejected, you know, because he was not white, he worked with the NAACP on a lawsuit. The idea is if you can get a court to say, actually, your rule is against the law, then that makes it so that not only could he go, you know, to Ole Miss Law School, but they would have to let other Black people in, and then it would help establish a precedent for suing other schools. So you would be able to kind of legally break down that barrier.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, so his lawyer on the case was Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall was the first Black Supreme Court justice for the Supreme Court, my brain, sorry. And he was the lawyer who later that year won the Brown versus the Board of Education case.
Okay.
Yeah. So they lost the case against Ole Miss.
Okay.
Actually, the first Black person who was admitted to Ole Miss was James Meredith. And I'm not exactly sure how Medgar helped him with this, but it did say that he helped him with that.
Okay.
So Ole Miss was, I think, integrated somewhat soon after, but I need to look in. I did not look into the dates on that one. He did not win, but the NAACP, you know, took notice of him and hired him soon after to be an investigator. He was 28 years old at this point, and he was an investigator for a bit, but soon after got hired for the first field secretary position in the South. He was pretty much like, I think, the highest ranking NAACP member in the state of Mississippi. Okay. And he and his wife actually together established the first NAACP Mississippi state office together. And they moved to Jackson, Mississippi. For this purpose, they bought a 3-bedroom ranch style house at 2332. I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Guinness Street. And this was a subdivision that was specifically built for Black people because Jackson, Mississippi was heavily segregated at this time. So in this position as field secretary in the South, what he did was registering people to vote, organizing boycotts, and he was trying to make the rest of the country aware of the racial violence that was happening in Mississippi. And one thing I had read was that Mississippi in particular, I think it was saying that Mississippi in particular was very difficult for the civil rights movement to gain traction in, just because a lot of really awful violence was happening in Mississippi that nobody outside of Mississippi knew about.
Gotcha. Okay.
And so a lot of his mission, when these acts of violence, when these crimes happened against Black people in Mississippi, Medgar would investigate them. You know, he's not a member of law enforcement, but he would go in, and because you couldn't really trust law enforcement to carry out these investigations well. Right. So starting in 1954, he would go in and he would ask questions. He would get his own testimony. He would take photos of it, and he would make sure that people knew what was happening. And so, for example, he investigated the murder of Emmett Till.
Okay.
You know, the 14-year-old who, in 1955, he was beaten to death for allegedly flirting with a white woman.
Right.
Medgar wouldn't just go in there, like, going up to law enforcement in these different rural areas that he was traveling to in the state and say, hello, I'm from the NAACP. Can I talk to you about the case? Because, no, that would not work out well for him.
No.
So what he did was he would dress as a field hand and he would go and talk to, like, everyday people who were in the town. He would actually talk to the people who these things were happening around and happening to. And that's how he would get the information. But it was, if you can guess it, extremely dangerous to do so.
Right.
So he was so frequently chased out of town by angry segregationists that he bought an extremely powerful car with a powerful engine and would often be leaving town speeding at 100 miles per hour because he was being chased.
Oh.
It was very dangerous. And one other thing I wanted to bring up before we get to a different section on this, way I have it divided up in my notes, is that he ended up developing a new role for the NAACP. Previously, before him, it had really just been, like I talked about doing this via the courts, about dismantling the laws and rules just by kind of going in there, suing, arguing your case and saying this is not, I don't know if they were saying it wasn't according to the Constitution. My guess is that it was a case-by-case basis, but the idea is they were going in there and arguing it out in the courts and trying to change it legally. And of course, that is like still a huge part of what they're doing. But he added a new role for it because he was doing grassroots work. He was getting people to, on an individual basis, be involved in this activism themselves. He was trying to get people to be involved in care who might have not done previously. It was really about changing people's minds.
Right.
On this. And obviously the NAACP did a lot of work on this after that, but one of the things I read is that Medgar was really a trailblazer in that department. So there was a lot of backlash against him from white supremacists as he was completing this work. His wife Merle would later tell NPR in an interview, quote, I lived in fear of losing him. He lived being constantly aware that he could be killed at any time. People would call the house all the time to threaten him, and their house was actually attacked with a firebomb in May 1963. Oof. And after that firebomb took place, nobody was hurt, by the way.
Okay.
But he had three kids at the time, Rena, his daughter, who was eight, a son, Daryl, and then Van, who was the youngest boy. And he would kind of make a game to teach his kids a drill if they ever heard a loud bang. So what they would do is they would drop to the floor, and then they would get to the tub in the bathroom. Because his family was particularly vulnerable, he would be at protests late at night, and his family would be there alone. And obviously people knew where they lived because, you know, the firebombing, but also people started putting KKK flyers and brochures all along the street, which again is a black neighborhood.
Oh my God.
I found this incredibly helpful article. It was written in 1992, but it's by somebody who had known Medgar while he was alive.
Okay.
It's this person, Michael Dorman, wrote for the New York Times an article called Who Killed Medgar Evers? And so in it, he talks about going to visit Medgar on June 3rd, 1963, in his NAACP office. And in that time, he was organizing a sit-in, Medgar was, that was getting people particularly angry at him. And Medgar said this to him at that meeting. "Someone's been following me wherever I go, and I'm getting plenty of calls. They say I'm going to be dead soon, that they're going to blow up my house, that they're going to blow my head off. One man who called was obviously holding a pistol. He spun the cylinder, so I could hear it was a revolver. Then he said, 'This is for you.' I told him, 'Well, whenever my time comes, I'm ready.' And I am. If I die, it will be in a good cause. I'm fighting for America just as much as the soldiers in Vietnam." So,
wow.
About 8 days later, on June 11th, Medgar was at a protest late into the night, which was pretty normal. His neighbor, Thomas Young, was actually watching over the house that night. I don't know if this was a previous arrangement or just something he decided to do, but everybody in the neighborhood obviously knew what was happening because, you know, you had the brochures, you had the firebombing. They knew who Medgar Evers was. Medgar Evers was incredibly well known in Mississippi.
Okay.
And he was watching the house, specifically looking to see if anybody was going to come by with a firebomb, and he was holding a .22 rifle. Okay.
Okay.
So he saw Medgar come home at 12:40 a.m. that night. So it was June 12th now. Medgar was driving up in his 1962 blue Oldsmobile, and he got out of the car when he was in the carport, and he was holding a whole bunch of NAACP t-shirts. And then Medgar was shot in the back, and the bullet went through his chest, and he fell forward.
Mm.
Thomas ran up to Medgar, and then a neighbor of theirs, Houston Wells, was also running up too. Houston was holding a pistol, and he fired a shot into the air to warn the person who had shot Medgar that they had weapons now, and so don't come anymore, you know?
Right.
So they went up to him, and the family then came out of the house. The kids had first done the drill, and then they were concerned, and they all came out, and Myrtle was saying, "Oh my God," and the kids were screaming for their dad to get up. So Houston and Thomas got a mattress from Houston's house, and they put Medgar on it and put that into the car and took him to the hospital, where he died after being there for about 15 minutes.
Oh, gosh.
So the detectives are investigating that night. So there's a detective named John Chambly, and they're all out in front of the house. Police have swarmed to the house. And John Chambly stands and can kind of tell where the bullet must have come from, the trajectory of it. And he looked over and saw a honeysuckle bush where it would have come from. And he noticed that the vines were broken, like somebody had been in it.
Right.
There was a gun in it, a 1917 30.06 Enfield rifle with the serial number 105-2682. This was very clearly the murder weapon. It was registered to Byron D. LeBeckwith, and it had a scope on it that was registered to Byron D. LeBeckwith, and the scope had a fingerprint on it that was matched to Byron D. LeBeckwith.
Okay. The court case was 20 years long.
This is where it gets... The trials of it was complicated.
Okay.
There was no other suspect. Let's just say that.
Okay.
So Byron D. LeBeckwith was born in California but his mother's family was from the South. And so when he was 5 years old, he moved back with her to Mississippi. And by the way, his family had used to own plantations in the Mississippi Delta, like, you know, further back. He served in World War II, like Medgar did, and was injured by a machine gun. And when he came back, he was treated like a war hero. Oh, he moved back to Greenwood, Mississippi, by the way, so about 80 miles from Jackson.
Okay.
He was known for being just extremely racist. Ooh. So,
in the 1950s, you're known for being extremely racist.
Yeah, yeah. Like, a lot of people are very racist, and they're all like, this guy is extremely racist.
Okay.
So, in 1961, for example, people were starting to say that it looked like in Greenwood there would be black people doing kneel-ins. So think sit-ins, where you refuse to move from whites-only establishments, but a kneel-in in the local church.
Okay.
And Beckwith decided the solution was to stand on the church steps holding a gun. And the pastor kind of fussed at him for doing this.
Okay.
And Beckwith got off the steps and walked away. And in 1967, he ran for lieutenant governor of Mississippi. There were about five other candidates, and he finished second to last. So, didn't get a lot of votes, but still did get some votes.
Right.
And his platform involved, quote, absolute white supremacy, end quote.
Like, that was written on his pamphlets, like, absolute white supremacy.
You know, I don't know, because I put it in quotes, and I don't know if I was quoting that article. If I was, it was Who Killed Medgar Evers. I don't know if that was me quoting or them quoting at this point.
Okay.
Beckwith founded the White Citizens Council in Mississippi. And in 1963, when the murder took place, he was a tobacco salesman, 42, and he was sending letters to newspapers that were very pro-segregation. And like I said, he was, by this point, very well known for hating black people as well as Jewish people.
Okay.
It took him 10 days to get arrested. All right, but at this point, he's arrested.
Okay.
So, in 1963, they were selecting a jury for the trial. And the reason I'm putting this detail in there is because I think it is just adding further context to the fact that some people didn't think it was a crime for white people to kill black people, like literally didn't think it was a crime. So the DA at the time, the district attorney, was William Waller. And he would ask white people who were being considered for the jury, quote, do you believe it is a crime to kill an N-word in Mississippi? Except he did not use the term N-word.
Right.
He
used the actual word.
He used the actual N-word. And if people hesitated when they gave their answer, they were not going to be part of the jury.
Well, that's good.
Yes, but yeah. It's just, I wanted to include that, like, that was just a thing you had to ask.
Right.
And that some people hesitated.
No, yeah, no, it's horrible that he had to ask, but it's good that he was asking and therefore getting people with personal biases
at least personal biases that were to that extreme.
Right.
Because I think you can kind of infer that there were a lot of personal biases going on in the jury anyway.
Right.
So I'm just going to, like, let you know, because it's going to get confusing if I just do it plainly chronologically. There were two trials in 1964 against Beckwith. And obviously this is not the end of the legal battle, but I'm going to refer to things and be like, I think this happened in the first trial, but maybe it happened in the second trial. So just so you know, we're talking about the same short period of time.
Okay.
So Beckwith, during the first trial, possibly the second, testified on his own behalf and said he didn't kill Medgar, so he was pleading not guilty. And he, I guess on the stand, talked about how he was pro-segregation. He had said that the gun, because, like I said, his fingerprint was on the scope and the gun were registered to him. He said that it had been stolen from him 2 days before the murder, therefore it was not him. And he got people to say that he wasn't in Jackson that night, but was in his hometown of Greenwood, which, again, was 80 miles away.
Right. Okay. He got people to say, you may be getting into this.
Okay. Witnesses said that they saw him. And I believe that it was actually three police officer witnesses said that they saw him in Greenwood that night. Based on later things, we are inferring that he got them to lie.
Okay, got it.
Yes. During the first trial, Governor Barnett, governor of Mississippi, came down and, in front of the jury, shook Beckwith's hand. If that's not like pressure, pressuring a jury, I don't know what is.
Right.
By the way, the jury was all white, all male, and the jury would later deadlock.
Okay.
So it was a hung jury, and Beckwith in the first trial was not convicted. And when it came out that it was a hung jury, which means, you know, they couldn't decide, mm-hmm. and there was no outcome other than Beckwith was not convicted.
Right.
But he wasn't acquitted. There were a lot of civil rights activists who were kind of surprised that they didn't just go ahead and say he wasn't guilty, because they were kind of expecting that to happen in this case, just based off of precedent. I haven't really encountered a lot of people, and looking back at this, that didn't think Beckwith was guilty.
Okay.
So it's not like they thought he wasn't guilty, and he was just saying they were kind of surprised that it didn't come out that way in court, just because that's what usually would happen in this case.
Right.
There was a second trial soon after. A different all-white, all-male jury that also deadlocked. So no okay. outcome either way.
I feel like if that happens twice, you should just assume that the guy's guilty, you know? I mean, I'm talking about, like, retrospect. Like,
okay, yes. Retrospectively, yes. In general, innocent until proven guilty.
If it was happening today, it would be one thing. But, like, we can look back and say, with how racist they are, the fact that two all-white juries were like, he might be guilty, actually.
Yeah.
You know, like, that kind of proves he was guilty.
You don't normally have that friction. So the fact that you had the friction this time is huge. So after these trials, Merle, his wife, Medgar's wife.
Yeah.
Big distinction there. Moved to California with the kids. And she went to a Pomona college there. And she got a sociology degree. And she became the first Black woman as a member of the Los Angeles Commission of Public Works. She goes on to do a lot of cool things that I'm going to get into later.
Okay.
Yes. Also, BT Dubs. Okay. She was always still looking for evidence that could result in a conviction. So it wasn't like, this can't ever happen again. Like, it wasn't a, well, now you did two trials, so now you can't do a trial again. So she's still hoping for that. And she married another civil rights activist in 1976 named Walter Williams. She legally changed her name to Merle Evers Williams. Oh. But with her work fighting for civil rights, she would mostly go by Merle Evers.
Okay.
Okay. Because of her husband, obviously. Right. Nothing moved forward in the case from 1965 until 1989. When the newspaper, the Jackson Clarion Ledger, reporter Jerry Mitchell published an article that said he had found some interesting things, that the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission, which was a pro-segregationist group of the time that was no longer by the time the article came out in 1989, had apparently helped Beckwith in his second trial as they were selecting jury members, because apparently they were trying to ensure via the commission that no Black people or Jewish people would get on the jury.
Okay.
So when the article about jury tampering came out, Merle came back to Jackson for a little bit to meet with the current DA, Ed Peters, and his assistant DA, Bobby DeLauder, and she was wanting to see if they would reopen the case. And they said, if you can find evidence of jury tampering, then yeah, you can probably get a new case. But they looked into it, and they actually just couldn't really find the evidence on the jury tampering itself. But by looking into it, they came across new witnesses that it seems DeLauder was in particular hoping could mean they could get a third trial.
Okay.
These new witnesses, by the way, were people who had, in the years since the trial, heard Beckwith brag about killing Medgar Evers. The trouble with doing a trial about 30 years after the original two trials is that you don't have a lot of the evidence anymore. They did not have the trial transcripts. A lot of the witnesses were dead. They didn't even have the murder weapon anymore. But, luckily, Merle didn't tell anybody this, and she waited a bit to send this to DeLauder. I think maybe because she was a little bit nervous mm-hmm. about what would happen with them. She actually had the original trial transcripts, which means it's 963 pages. That is like a word-for-word transcription of everything that went down in that first trial. It is incredible amount of evidence. They had to officially get a court. Bless you.
Sorry.
They had to get a court to officially confirm that they could use this as evidence, but they could. And it was really, really helpful because for some of the witnesses who were dead or they couldn't get a hold of, they were allowed to use their original testimony.
Oh, that's good.
That's huge.
Yeah.
And it was also really helpful for building their case, which kind of means, okay, they didn't have to start from the ground up. Here's the thing. The murder weapon, again, they didn't have the murder weapon. It had somehow disappeared since after the second trial.
Somehow.
And here's a weird part of the case that is going to sound fake, but isn't.
Okay.
Bobby DeLauder, assistant DA, was working the case, and he, you know, was trying to find all this missing evidence, and he did work on this for years. And then he kind of remembered something vaguely. He was in the process of divorcing his wife, and his wife's father had passed away a bit ago, but his wife's father had been a judge. And he remembered his father-in-law saying to him, his father-in-law was Russell D. Moore III, and he said that Russell had showed him a rifle and said it was from a civil rights case. And so Bobby DeLauder was like, wait one second. He called his mother-in-law and asked if he could come over and look at the gun. He came over and he looked at the gun and he looked at the serial number and it was 1052682. It was the gun used to kill Medgar Evers.
What the heck?
I know, right?
Oh
I know,
my gosh.
Right?
Like, that's a coincidence beyond coincidence.
I know,
like,
it sounds so fake.
That's like the universe going, and then I'm going to put this here.
I'm going to put this here. I mean, I'm glad he remembered it, but, like, also, even if he didn't, I don't know, I'm just thinking, like, that could have, even if it was, like, okay, his father-in-law had said this was a gun from a civil rights case, I'm sure there's whole bunches of guns from civil rights cases. It could have been anyone, but it was this one. It was this rifle.
Yeah.
Wow. So this was really big, for one thing. And among the new evidence they had, gotta go into it, Delmar Dennis was a KKK member who turned FBI informant. So he would tell the FBI what people had said at all these KKK meetings and rallies, et cetera, et cetera. And it should not surprise you that Beckwith was a member of the KKK.
Okay.
Okay. He said that Beckwith, and this is in the years after the 1964 trials, okay? He said that Beckwith was speaking at some sort of meeting they were having in the KKK, and he was saying that he killed Medgar. He didn't say Medgar's name specifically, mm-hmm. but it was very clear who he was talking about. And consider this, I mean, it was a well-known case.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it was understood.
And I, in that mindset of who this man is, I mean, killing a civil rights activist would be something to be very, very proud of.
He was incredibly proud of it. This is not the only guy who came forward saying that he was bragging about it.
Gotcha.
Dan Prince used to have Beckwith as his landlord, and he said Beckwith also bragged about killing Medgar to him. In 1973, Beckwith was intercepted in New Orleans by police. He was taking a bomb to use against a leader of the Anti-Defamation League there, and he told an officer straight up, I shot Medgar Evers. And then in that same instance, he is being guarded, you know, at like, it said it was like not prison. It was like, I don't know if it was like a hospital part of a prison or a prison part of a hospital.
Gotcha.
Not sure which, but it's in that same thing. He was in New Orleans for this incident. And one of his guards was Mark Reilly or Riley. And he also said that Beckwith was bragging to him about it and said that the reason he got off was because he knew people in high places.
Uh-huh.
All right? So you got those four new people saying, in the meantime, Beckwith is just bragging about this to apparently anybody who would listen, honestly.
Right.
And then you have four people come forward who did not testify in the original two trials, and they said that Beckwith was at the rally that Medgar was at the night Medgar was killed. So as in, like, he was there watching him. And this contradicts the witnesses who said that Beckwith was in Greenwood that night. You cannot be in two places at once. The four people who came forward saying that he was at the rally said that they didn't come forward originally because they didn't think there was any chance that Beckwith would get convicted for it.
Got
at
it.
The time. They move forward to trial.
Okay.
The first thing that needs to happen is that Beckwith needs to be charged again. So in 1990, he is charged once more with murdering Medgar. Beckwith is 70 years old. He is living... He's living in Signal Mountain, Tennessee, with his wife, Thelma. Their house, FYI, has a Confederate battle flag out front.
Awesome. Cool.
He is arrested, and he is sent to jail in Chattanooga, and later sent to jail in Mississippi from there. It takes a while for this thing to go to trial. It takes 4 years for this thing to go to trial. He is released from prison on bond in 1992, and the trial starts in February 1994. This time, it is not an all-white jury. It's actually 8 black people and 4 white people.
Okay.
Unlike the first 2 trials, he did not take the stand, so he did not testify. And it should be noted that one of the original police officer witnesses who said they saw Beckwith in Greenwood did come back and testify again at this trial and say, I still stand by that I saw Beckwith in Greenwood that night. So you have that guy, but you also have a whole bunch more people who are coming forward and saying they saw him at the rally. It didn't seem like this trial took very long. I think the outcome came out on February 6th, and I think the trial started in February, but I could be wrong on the dates. But anyway, he was convicted. The jury deliberated for 6 hours, and when they read out the verdict, he did not show emotion, and people in the halls were cheering, and he was sentenced on the same day to life in prison.
Okay.
He ended up serving less than 7 years total, because he died in 2001 when he was 80 years old.
That's the part that kind of sucks the most, is, like, he was found guilty, but he got to, like, live his entire life.
He got to live an entire life.
That was basically retirement for him.
Mm-hmm. He got to live an entire life. Yeah, that's just the sad thing of it. He got to have all of that, and he took that away from somebody else. And he was just thrilled as could be about it.
Right.
Yeah. Remember that article, Who Shot Medgar Evers, that was really helpful in the research of this? The author of the article, Michael Dorman, he went to Beckwith's house to talk with his wife, and this was, again, this article came out in 1992, so this was before the trial, but after the charge and the arrest. He went to talk to Thelma, and Thelma was talking to him, and they had been married in 1983, so she didn't know him when Medgar was shot, and she told the journalist that she had been a nurse for a long time, and she said, you know, when people are under anesthesia, they tell you the truth. So Beckwith, she said, had heart surgery or something about an artery, and he was under anesthesia, and she asked him who shot Medgar Evers, and he said, I don't know, but he sure is dead. So he didn't admit to it, at least according to his wife, and we can go ahead and say that that's not necessarily the most reliable source. So he didn't admit to it. There's just so much, there's no other suspect. It is so clear that he did this. I think what I find most interesting from that little tidbit and encounter is that she was married to this man. She was so unsure about it that she waited until he was under anesthesia. And in her head, she was like, and I can get anything, like any kind of information, and this is what I need to know. And she asked that question.
Right.
I don't know. That was just very interesting to me, but like you're a little bit of an insight into that marriage of how unsure she must have been about who he was as a person, and yet you were married to this person.
And yet, at the same time, she's married to a man who's actively in the KKK, who actively brags that he killed a civil rights activist. So, I mean, I can't imagine she would be too upset if he had said, yeah, I did it.
You can't, you know, and that's the thing. Maybe she wouldn't have been. Maybe this was a thing she casually wondered, and I'm reading a lot into this when maybe there was just not a lot of weight behind that question.
And it could have been the opposite way, like, he's always bragging that he was the one who killed him, and she's like, oh, I don't think you did it, but you're bragging about it, and so she was trying to prove him wrong.
That could be it. I mean, yeah. And you know, there are, you and I know this, an awful lot of random people who will confess to crimes they didn't commit.
Yes, especially if they think it'll make them look better for some reason.
Yeah. I firmly believe this is not one of those cases.
Okay.
When the verdict was read out, Merle and her family exited the courthouse, and she spoke to reporters outside. She had a big, big smile on her face. And in a New York Times article by Ronald Smothers titled, "White Supremacist is Convicted of Slaying Rights Leader in 63, she said, "My God, I don't have to say accused assassin anymore. Now I can say convicted assassin." She went on to say that this conviction makes it clear you cannot kill Black people and expect no repercussions. She said, "Medgar's life is not in vain, and perhaps he did more in death than he could have in life. Somehow, I think he is still among us."
Aww.
So, Medgar, as a World War II veteran, was buried in Arlington National Cemetery. After he died in that same year, 1963, the NAACP gave him the Spingarn Medal. It is a medal that is given out only once a year, and it's given out to one African-American person per year. Other winners include Martin Luther King Jr., W.E.B. Du Bois, and poets like Langston Hughes and Maya Angelou. In terms of the field secretary position, Medgar's brother, Charlie Evers, got that position after he died, and he actually became the first Black mayor of a multiracial town in the South since Reconstruction, because he became mayor of Fayette, Mississippi.
Okay.
The home, the three-bedroom ranch-style house that the Evers lived in while they were in Jackson, Mississippi, was named a National Historic Landmark by President Obama. And in 2020, the Trump administration made it into a national monument.
Okay.
Medgar's death, by the way, particularly got people in the northern U.S. invested in the civil rights movement, the story of it. And then I want you to know, like, you know, so his memory is living on in the nation, but also specifically in Jackson, Mississippi, on the 58th anniversary of his death. So I wonder if this is an annual thing, but I'm not exactly sure. There was a memorial outside the house for him and also his brother, because his brother had died in 2020, and this was in 2021. And at the event, family members and local leaders spoke on their legacies and the importance of remembering our history. There have been movies about Medgar Evers. There was one that was made for TV, I believe in the 80s, and it shares the name of a book that Murley co-wrote with William Peters. And the movie is called For Us, the Living, the Medgar Evers Story. There is another movie that I kind of want to talk about a little bit, and it's called Ghosts of Mississippi. And this seems to be much better known than the For Us, the Living. And it came out in 1996 and is really about the time between 1989 and 1994, when interest in the case started coming back up and they actually brought it to trial and convicted Byron D. LeBeckwith. It was high budget because it had big names. Alec Baldwin starred as Bobby DeLauder, and Whoopi Goldberg as Merle. And I kind of want to talk about this. So this is actually, I watched this movie last weekend, and that's what got me wanting to research Medgar Evers and talk about his story. But one of the things I also kind of wanted to talk about is just touching on this movie as a whole, because I'm glad I got to learn about Medgar Evers' case through it, but also it, I think, is a really prime example of, this is a story that should really be about Medgar and the civil rights movement, Murley, and, you know, Whoopi Goldberg is in it, but in terms of who the main character of the movie is and the narrative arc, it really follows Bobby DeLauder. And I just, I wanted to kind of talk through my feelings about that.
Yeah.
A little
yeah.
bit. So Bobby, and I mean, it's interesting. It is undeniably interesting because it is a lot about him breaking away from the, like, ingrained institutional racism that he kind of grew up with to pursue this case and fight for justice, and kind of reckoning with his own experience of being a white person growing up in the racist South. And it has this one really interesting moment when he's talking with the character of the FBI informant. And the FBI informant is kind of telling him, "Hey, I don't want to testify in this case because I've already made up for my wrongs." And then Alec Baldwin asks him something along the lines of, "Do we ever truly make up for the wrong that we've done?" And the movie almost had like a pause after that moment. And I think that it was implying that this question is not necessarily about either one of the characters necessarily. It is not about individuals necessarily. I think it was very much about the South as a whole, because so much pain and suffering and racial violence has occurred in the South when you're talking about slavery or Jim Crow era or to now. And so I think that that's a lot of a question that I think from my Southern literature course to just hearing a lot of things, is that we're kind of wrestling with, or even if we advance to a certain point, do we ever make up for the wrong that we've done as a culture, as a society, and not necessarily even as individuals? And I think that that's a very important question, but it was also very weird realizing about a third of the way through this movie that the story about Medgar Evers in name is really much more about Bobby DeLauder. And Whoopi Goldberg as Merley, she reaches the height of her narrative arc when she decides to give the transcripts to DeLauder, which means she trusts him enough. And it felt weird that in this story about her husband's death and the fight that she really contributed to get him to have a third trial, to find justice for it, is that it's about her needing to trust a white guy.
Right.
And it was just kind of interesting to see, even in this story, the white person very much at the center of it. And so I was happy to see that there was another movie about Medgar Evers out there. But like I said, I think it was created a long time ago and there's not a lot on it out there, not nearly as much as this very high budget film. And I also kind of wanted to take a moment to talk about Merley.
Okay. Oh, right. And all the awesome work she did in California.
Not just in California, really. It was everywhere. So the NAACP page that was on her actually kind of specified something that I did not see in my other research, but I was happy to see here, which is that she actually worked with Medgar in the office they had established for the NAACP in Mississippi, investigating and organizing protests. She put together a book of a lot of the things Medgar had written and published it in 2005, and it was titled The Autobiography of Medgar Evers, A Hero's Life and Legacy Revealed Through His Writings, Letters, and Speeches. Like I said, she was the first Black woman appointed to the Board of Public Works in Los Angeles. The mayor appointed her. And she became a member of the NAACP Board of Directors in the 1990s and was actually chair of the NAACP from 1995 to 1998. Yeah. And the NAACP specifically put on their page that they were kind of going through financial straits at the time, and she really sorted them out and helped them through it.
Okay.
And after she stepped down, she worked on establishing the Medgar Evers Institute in Jackson, Mississippi. She had a biography come out in 1995 of, I think she wrote it, or yeah, so it was an autobiography. Watch Me Fly, What I Learned on the Way to Becoming the Woman I Was Meant to Be. She has been awarded 7 honorary doctorates.
Oh, wow.
And when Obama was reelected, when he had the inauguration in 2013, she led the invocation, a prayer that is traditionally done by a male clergyman. I don't think it had ever been done by somebody who wasn't a man. Okay. And she led it. And that is a really, really big deal, I think. And I loved reading about her and hearing about all the wonderful things she did throughout her lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And just commenting on the Civil Rights Acts, kind of summing up a little bit what I was talking about earlier. In 1957, Eisenhower signed the Civil Rights Act, which says you cannot tell other people they can't vote if they have the right to vote.
Right.
The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was signed by Lyndon B. Johnson, saying employers cannot discriminate on gender, race, religion, etc. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 by Johnson. You really had to hammer in the voting thing. There were lots of people trying to do workarounds. Yeah. Established no more literacy tests, and that the federal government had a bigger hand in ensuring voting rights. And the Civil Rights Act of 1968 by Johnson meant no discrimination for housing. And the reason I bring all of this up is because, like I said earlier, Jim Crow was instituted in all the different facets of life. And it took over a decade of work and resulting legislation to undo its ties on Black people in the South.
Right.
Anyway, yeah. Thanks for letting me talk a lot about that. I really, really, really enjoyed learning all about this case.
Well, thank you very much for sharing, because not only is this true crime, but we also learned something, and I feel like it's deeply Southern. So thank you, Robin.
Very deeply Southern. Yeah. If you like today's episode, you can like, subscribe, review, tell a friendo, and also join our Patreon at patreon.com/hauntedhospitality. It is $3 a month, and you get a new episode every month.
Yes, on the 13th, because we're spooky. If you want to see Robin's sources, you can go to hauntedhospitality.wordpress.com. And if you'd like to share your own spooky story, whether it be true crime or paranormal, you can write to us at hauntedhospitalitypodcast@gmail.com.
We are also on the interwebs at Facebook and Instagram and TikTok at Haunted Hospitality and Twitter at Haunted Hosts. We hope to see you there.
Stay spooky. Close enough.
Okay, good.